We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Populations of elephants have fallen drastically, dramatically, due to wars, starvation, mass culls, poaching, and habitat loss. This has left many young elephants orphaned, bereft of elders to mentor them. Without that guidance, these traumatized elephants are in trouble. They become aggressive toward people, other elephants, and one another, and other species, I should say. Today on the program, we're going to talk about the emotional lives of elephants, the similarities between elephants and humans, and our response to the elephant's plight. Our guest is Gay Bradshaw. She is the author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. Join the discussion with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Gay Bradshaw, G.A. Bradshaw, holds doctorates in ecology and psychology. She is the director of the Karoulos Center, which was established to care for animals suffering from human-caused trauma and prevent future harm. She is also the president and co-founder of the Trans Species Institute. Her book, Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity, is published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Gay Bradshaw, it's good to talk with you. How are you?
Good afternoon.
It's nice to be with you this afternoon. Well, I mentioned the Karoulos Center and its work. Can you tell us a little something about the Trans Species Institute?
Well, the Trans Species Institute was co-founded with my colleague, Dr. Toni Frohoff, who is the director of Terramar Research, and her work is centered on dolphins and whales. Most of my work has been working with terrestrial and avian populations, and so we joined together to create the Trans Species Institute, which is really the educational arm of both Karoulos and Terramar. And we basically conduct a number of different kinds of educational programs, including webinars, workshops, and collaborative types of projects.
And if people are interested in learning more about Karoulos, they can find the organization online at www.karoulos.org, and that's K-E-R-U-L-O-S, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. The first chapter of your book asks, who is an elephant, not what is an elephant? As you note, for most of us, that's an unfamiliar way to begin a consideration of the elephant. Why do you want us to consider the question, who is an elephant?
Well, that first chapter really establishes the impetus or the basis for shifting from objectifying elephants and other animals to understanding them as sentient, feeling beings like we do ourselves. And the impetus from that comes from the science. It's been around for hundreds of years, even before Charles Darwin. But there has been, as you know, there's been some kind of reluctance and resistance to understanding humans and animals in the same breath and on the same level. So what the science tells us is basically the structures, the cogs and the processes and the mechanisms of the brain of both elephants and humans, and this is inclusive of other animals, are pretty much the same. And they all govern these characteristics and attributes that we, again, once thought were uniquely human, things like culture and sense of self and identity and emotions. And so now that science has established that this truly is the case, that we share common mental and psychological capacities, then it is justified to talk about, and I would say ethically we're compelled also, to talk about elephants in the who as opposed to the that.
Yeah. One of the things you say early on is that elephants are self-aware. How do we know an animal has a sense of self, is self-aware?
Well, there's a number of different ways, but perhaps the most formalized way is using what they call the mirror self-recognition test, which is described in the book and was performed recently at the Bronx Zoo, demonstrating that elephants have a sense of self. And what that is basically is having an individual, like an elephant, having a mirror in front of them and seeing how they respond. In some cases, that the animal does not, or the individual does not react to that mirror. But if they do and they show that they are recognizing themselves, then that's one indication that there is this notion of an identity.
Yeah. If we acknowledge that the elephant is self-aware, what are the implications for how we treat elephants?
Well, I think it's good to ask the opposite question. You know, assuming that we have assumed that the elephant has not had a sense of self, has not had a psyche like us, and what has that allowed us to do to elephants? Elephants and other animals are largely property, considered property legally. They are. It's acceptable to have them in captivity, to do things to them physically, psychologically, and emotionally that is prohibited to humans. So essentially, now that we have scientific evidence of self-awareness, of these qualities that make elephants comparable to humans, then what's called into question are the ethics and the laws that have allowed us to do things that we wouldn't allow to do to ourselves, to elephants. So it's a profound challenge to our culture.
Yeah. Here's a statistic that is alarming, just one of many in the book, Elephants on the Edge. In the 1960s, Uganda had an estimated 30,000 elephants. By 1982, 2,000. What happened to Uganda's elephants?
Well, what happened to the elephants in Uganda is very much what happened to elephants everywhere. They were slaughtered. Their habitat was destroyed, and today it's even more dire because the remaining pockets of habitat and populations are under siege by escalating poaching and also now a severe drought in Africa. So habitat destruction, poaching for ivory, hunting for trophies, all have caused mass drops in elephant populations.
How has this drastic, dramatic drop in the population of Uganda's elephants affected those who survive?
Well, again, this is where we unfortunately have learned lessons that shows that elephants are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or what we call PTSD, in very much the same way that humans are. The same mechanisms and structures in the brain that provide or allow or give the capacity for self-awareness in an elephant also makes them psychologically vulnerable to life-threatening violence. So the survivors, essentially in Uganda and other elephants, are showing symptoms, psychological symptoms and behavioral patterns that are reflective of individuals who have undergone incredible severe stress and trauma. And essentially that's what the survivors of these, what we would call in human terms, genocides are showing.
Mm. What has been the effect on elephant society?
Well, it's very much the similar that we see in human societies. When you have long-term violence, mass deaths, the loss of elders, again, there's been what they call selective hunting for those individuals with ivory, with large tusks. What you have is a flattening of the society. You have a breakdown of the society. There are no particular, you know, consistent structures and processes socially that help nurture the young elephants and actually help them heal and recover from their trauma. So essentially what you have is a society in disarray and breaking down.
Mm. Would you tell us about Dame Daphne Sheldrick and her work rearing infant orphaned elephants?
Well, that's a bright, shining light
yeah.
to all the dire statistics and tragedies. Dame Daphne lives just outside of Nairobi, and for over 50 years now, she has been rescuing orphan baby elephants taking them in, nurturing them, saving them, and being able to raise them so that they are once more able to reintroduce into the wild herds. And she does this by recreating an elephant family. And it's not just with other baby elephants. What she does is she and elephant keepers are creating essentially an elephant family that is manned and womaned by humans. And that is the natal family, which is absolutely critical for the young elephant brain and mind to develop in. They take care of the elephants physically, mentally, and emotionally, teach them elephant values and ways, and in that way brings a baby elephant from severe trauma into what we would call normal types of socialization and healing, and therefore they are able to survive and return to the wild and raise families on their own without showing the kinds of symptoms that we've seen elsewhere which are indicative of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Hmm. So these elephants are resilient.
Well, I think in general, everyone is pretty resilient. Hmm. It's just what the environment can actually provide. It's incredibly difficult for an individual to survive under severe trauma. And, of course, we have chronicles from that from human history, where we're looking at the trials of prisoners of war, concentration camp prisoners, individuals. They're tremendously resilient, but the mind and body can only take so much. And so, you know, sanctuaries and the work of Dame Daphne and people like her are absolutely critical for retaining and nurturing the resilience which is innate in different societies.
How do we take what we know about war, genocide, and suffering, and the trauma that it causes to humans, and apply it to elephants?
Well, I think if you talk to most any psychiatrist or psychologist about what can we learn about human genocide and trauma, and how we might stop that for humans, we can apply that to elephants. The first step is to prevent trauma from happening. In the case of elephants, that means banning ivory, which would stop poaching. This is what experts are saying, that we need to ban ivory. Stop relocating them, translocating them around the countryside, much like chess pieces. What we learn, really, and what people like Cynthia Moss, who is the director of the Amboseli Elephant Trust, has been studying elephants for over 30 years, that elephant society is not just a collection of individual elephants. It's a network, a very complex tapestry of relationships and knowledge. So we need to be able to design conservation and then ways of living ourselves that does not tear the fabric of elephant society. So to prevent trauma, we need to be able to create or to reinstate the kinds of conditions in the environment, the kinds of conditions psychologically that really support elephant society, the reverse of which have caused their breakdown. So preventing trauma means stopping poaching, stopping hunting, expanding their habitat, expanding their parks, giving protection, removing the kinds of stressors that cause the kinds of symptoms that we're seeing. Even things, for example, like attempts to quote-unquote curb elephant population. There's a myth, essentially, that the elephants are overpopulated. Essentially, they're on the brink of extinction, and scientists predict that they may go extinct by 2020. But there still is a move to say that that elephants are causing problems. They call that the elephant-human conflict. And so, therefore, we need to control their populations by imposing birth control. That in itself is a stressor because the animal has to get darted. It's very stressful on the body and mind, and you're disrupting their society. So in general, the things that we learn about ourselves in terms of having a peaceable society can be applied to elephants. We need to basically refrain from violence, both among ourselves and against other species.
Hmm. Gay Bradshaw is our guest here this afternoon on The Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of listeners waiting to join us this afternoon, so let's go and take a call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I am a huge fan of elephants, and I'm actually, your book is one that's been on my list for a while now.
Oh, lovely.
Are you familiar with the Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, Tennessee?
Yes, in fact, I've studied some of the elephants there, and I talk about them in the book, and in one chapter in particular is quite extensive.
It's absolutely been tremendous to me seeing the different PTSD symptoms as they've been developing, and it just really shows what we've managed to do to this absolutely tremendous, group of fellow Earthlings.
Yes.
That we share the planet with. I was curious, have you come across, I've heard different studies of memories being passed down from generation to generation of elephants where they've started becoming aggressive towards specific groups of people that they've, identified as a threat, and how their infants or their I'm not sure what the term is, the baby elephant starts becoming aggressive it's something that's passed down through that. Are you familiar with that at all?
Well, there have been some incidents that are reported in Kenya that talk about that elephants, and I talk about that also in the book, where the elephants have learned about particular human tribal members, that are threatening to elephants and others are not, and that they respond to different colors of their clothing that the tribesmen wear. And also even it's been speculated that they are engaging in a type of preemptive revenge by killing cattle. And so in formal terms, that's not unusual. It's social ecological knowledge that is passed down. And when we understand the elephant like humans, that has a very vast and deep culture, as well as a very complex and dynamic communication system, the whole idea of passing that information down, as we might do in traditions in our culture, is makes quite a bit of sense.
Yeah, it's absolutely tremendous. I can't, if you wouldn't mind giving some resources for ways people can get involved, I would really appreciate that as well.
Well, I at the back of the book, I say 10 things that you can do to help elephants. So you might want to take a look at that. You can go to the website, the Karulos website, and we have some things there as well. I would say, though, right now, what is really critical and timely is in March there's going to be a meeting, and it's a potential that there'll be countries in Africa that will be downlisting the elephant, the CITES downlisting. It is absolutely critical in whatever way you can, communicating to your congressman, writing letters, to really ask for poaching the ivory ban to be put into effect. That was done in the 1980s, and it had a tremendous help for the elephants. So we need to do that again before the elephants go extinct. And what's really important that you bring out as well is the notion it's not just the physical extinction. What we're seeing right now are the physical extinctions, but also the psychological and the cultural extinctions that's going on. The point you make about the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, those elephants, in contrast to Dame Daphne's in Kenya, those elephants are elephants that come from zoos and circuses that have sustained long-term stress and trauma, and they are in recovery. Now, those individuals, in fact, there's a group called the Divas, which are eight, Carol Buckley, who's the director of the elephant sanctuary, refers to them as the Divas. They are having to recreate their own culture because they basically lived in captivity from infanthood to when they were like in their 30s and 40s, and they really never experienced elephant culture and ways. So they're having to recreate it. And the very frightening thing is that's essentially the types of things that's happening in the wild. In other words, that the elephants in the wild, both in Asia and Africa, are sustaining literally, it's been hundreds of years of increasing stress and trauma and the breakdown of their culture. So the danger is not just the physical extinction of the elephant. What we're witnessing right now is really the social, psychological, and cultural extinction.
Let's take another call. A listener in Morris on line four. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Interested in this. This is a great great show on some of those species, the greatest species of wildlife out there. I was watching a National Geographic show here not too long ago where they were showing where all these the problems with the ivory and the you know the poaching and all that. To me, what it looked like they were showing was that the park rangers in these places were outmanned and outgunned. And I know I do realize there's groups of people or organizations that donate their volunteer time and efforts to try and keep these, you know, these great animals alive and to keep them from poaching. But from what I see, it doesn't sound like we're giving them enough, or at least organizations, other countries out there aren't giving them enough to deal with the situation. It's kind of antiquated. Am I not correct?
Well, definitely there is an understaffing in terms of being able to protect the elephants. There is, again, one of the, and this is analyses of various organizations have done in terms of how to stop the poaching, which right now has escalated because there's been these off sales of ivory. And the conclusion is, after a lot of, you know, analysis of economics and things like that, that it's critical to have an ivory ban, and that in itself will have a huge impact in terms of stopping the poaching. So that's a very important point that has been raised. In terms of also the protection, yes, there is an understaffing, and there needs to be some other things done simultaneously, like expanding habitat. One critical kind of thing to do is to connect the different kinds of parks together so that that will allow, be the first steps to really recreating or moving toward habitat that the elephants can actually use. In Asia, they're starving, and the same thing in Africa. And so you have incidents of elephants who are in search of food and water because of the drought in Africa, and they'll be going into crops, and that creates tremendous, you know, conflict, but they're starving. So there needs to be something done there in these different places that allows the elephant to survive, have the food, have the water, and we work for some sort of mediation types of process that will prevent the kinds of violence that is starting to escalate between humans and elephants.
Yeah, I would think if there was a way to get a helicopter crew down there to survey and keep an eye, because they did show one, and I don't know if it was Asia where this was at or not. I know they were showing clips from all over the world where these elephants were, but when they did have helicopters, they were able to catch pretty much 90% of the poachers out there.
Mm-hmm.
There was nowhere to hide, and that, I think, is a big plus as far as any organization. But my hats are off to you. I go to the zoos to see these people, these great mammals. I hope to God that they're you know, not in just the zoos anymore. I hope they're out there and in the wild where they belong, just like any other animal. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I've got another listener who wants to talk with you, but I want to ask you, what do you think the future of zoos is?
What do I think?
The future. What lies ahead for zoos?
You mean in terms of with this new information?
Yeah.
Well, I talk about this quite extensively in the book, and there's kind of a movement, both popular and within the scientific circles, to really change, you know, the ways in which we treat animals to meet what we know. And from the perspective of trans-species psychology, which essentially says it's the study of the mind using a common, you know, common framework, common concepts and models of the way we look at humans and animals in the same way, really says that places that are like circuses and zoos are very similar, the parallels are very strong to, you know, what we would call institutions of incarceration for humans. So from an ethical perspective and from what you know, even scientifically too, zoos are not supportive of animals. They are sources of stress. They cannot reproduce the conditions psychologically and physically that elephants and other animals need in order to survive and live healthily. So from that perspective, that they are not the kinds of places where we can look to have healthy animals in that way. So in terms of their future, that's really up to society. Given the knowledge that we have, given our understanding, what do we really want to do? And this is really what we're being challenged to. The whole quote-unquote discovery of psychological capacities and post-traumatic stress in elephants, the real significance of that is less about the animals than it is in terms of ourselves, our behavior, and our culture. We're being asked to say, we have this knowledge. What are we going to do with this knowledge? Are we going to change our behavior? Are we going to not do things to animals that we would not want to do to ourselves?
Hmm. Is that what leads you to say what befalls the elephant befalls humanity?
Yes, yes. And someone actually wrote me a letter and made a comment that what we do to other animals not only hurts them, but it hurts our soul. I thought that was quite poetic in that sense, that when we're hurting someone who is really our kin, we are hurting ourselves at the same time.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Savoy next on line two. Hi.
Hello. well, you've answered one of my questions. Apparently, we cannot think of the zoo as being a place for some of these traumatized young elephants. But to follow up with my one thought there before I get into the more important stuff, how would we get elephants over to this continent nowadays? I suppose it would still be by ship.
You mean how would you return elephants to...
Well, either way, if you were sending elephants from North America to Africa or Asia or from there to here, I suppose it's only done by ship. Would that be correct?
Well, I presume one... Yeah, I mean, I think that would probably be the most practical. But I guess what I mean, to me, I would... I guess the motivation you're saying is returning these individuals to their homeland. If it would be the, I think that,
no,
that it's very
no.
stressful for elephants to travel. So
yeah.
Sanctuaries, for example, like Maggie, who was an elephant up in Alaska, she was brought down to sanctuary in California, and a lot of the transportation within North America of elephants is in trucks, and that is extremely stressful for an elephant. So. Any kind of moving, and in Africa there's translocations in trucks and things like that, is very, very stressful for the elephant. So that type of thing has to be taken very judiciously, has to be considered very carefully, because it is a tremendous demand on that individual.
Well, yes, you've added to my previous conclusion that from your previous conversations with others that it's not practical to think of rescuing any of these elephants and bringing them over here. They have to stay over there. By the way, am I correct for thinking there are two kinds of elephants, the Asian elephant and the African elephant?
Yes. There's actually, there's other, well, whether there are other species or subspecies is debate, but yes, those are the two main groups.
Okay. Now, have you been mainly talking about the African elephants today? For these,
well,
these
as
traumas
I say,
and these... antisocial things and their lack of parents and their PTSD and that. I'm sort of thinking you've mainly been talking about the African elephants.
Well, essentially, but it really expands out to include Asian elephants. When I say this in the beginning of my book, talking about the conventions of the term elephant, and anything that I say really applies to all elephants. However, the specific things regarding these PTSD and the killing of the rhinoceroses, that happened in Africa. However, what's happening in Asia and India is very similar. I mean, we look at it from the perspective of traumatology. There's extreme social disruption and breakdown as well because of the massive losses in the numbers of elephants, the fragmentation of their habitat, the breaking up of their hierarchical structure in society. So the parallels are very strong and similar.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly have come across some previous ideas that the elephants might be among the more intelligent of the quadrupeds around. Is there any proof of this, or is it just sort of vaguely generally agreed, or is it true that elephants are far more intelligent than most of the other quadrupeds?
Well, I'll tell you my personal opinion is I think that that type of hierarchical thing, you know, someone is more intelligent than the other, is not that constructive. If you look at it from the perspective of the brain, all animals, and some people say include, you know, invertebrates, But definitely all mammals and altricial species, which would include all vertebrates and birds like parrots, pretty much have the same brain processes and mechanisms. In other words, we're looking at the same theme with some variations on that. And from that perspective, you know, one species is not more intelligent than the other. They just use their brain in different ways for different things.
Yeah. Maybe you would talk about the things that elephants do that we can relate to as human animals.
Well, I think one of the most significant things that people really relate to is their emotions and how they have formed very strong relationships with each other. Elephants are well known for their very profound feelings for one another and their care for each other. They have grieving rituals, visiting the bones, the whitened bones of their ancestors and relatives, and they bring their children back to visit these bones. They show great concern, and as a group, as a family, gather around anyone who is ill or dying and try to support them and try to save them. So emotions, I think, is something that people really relate to in terms of how elephants express in similar types of ways. And then I think in terms of the other component has to do with they are just intriguing. There's something that people relate to in elephants. They really see beneath the skin because elephants look so very different. So I'm not sure what it is, but there's an essence that people seem to relate to and find and resonate with elephants.
Yeah. Maybe you would tell us about some of the observations Dame Daphne Sheldrick has made about the personalities of the elephants that are in her care.
Well, you know, that's what's, you know, just one of these remarkable things, and also she's definitely the person to speak about it, is that she has, over the years, known probably hundreds of elephants, and seeing how everyone is an individual, just like a human being. You know, some elephants will be very, you know, tease each other, and they'll have a sense of humor. Others are more serious. Others are more, you know, nurturing. Others are leaders. And so they all have these different combinations of personality traits, very much like we see in ourselves.
How does one go about trying to recreate a human being? How does a human being go about trying to recreate elephant culture? How does Dame Daphne, how does she do it? What's a day like in, you know, in her life working with elephants?
Well, for one, you know, she's able to do what she does because she has spent decades of time observing and experiencing and interacting with elephants. And I have to say, I think that she is also intrinsically a genius. What she has done is she understands what is important for an elephant, not just physically, you know, and she invented this particular milk formula, by the way, that is just remarkable because what it does is it allows a baby elephant who may be just literally coming out of the womb to be able to survive on this milk. No one's been able to do that until she did. So not only does she do that physically, but she also knows what are the emotional kinds of conditions that an elephant needs. And the other is in terms of the social structure and the kinds of relationships. So we would call these, you know, psychological, sort of a psychological profile of an elephant and the emotional profile of an elephant and then the social profile. So what she does is she takes a baby in and they recreate a human and elephant composition of what they call the natal family, which is the mother and a set of allomothers, which are aunties and cousins and siblings. And that essentially is the nurturing unit, if you want to look at it that way, that really cares for that baby elephant. And each one of them contributes to the mind and the emotions of that baby elephant and well-being. And that group basically carries the baby along through the age of 10 years old. At that point, the young elephant is becoming a teenager, and they gradually start to get to know the older parts and the wild members of the elephant society and therefore reintegrate. So essentially what she does is she is the medium, the human medium, that bridges the baby and the ancient elephant culture and brings those together.
Mm. And is what she is doing, is it similar to what is being done in Tennessee at the sanctuary that you mentioned earlier?
Well, as I said earlier, the situations are somewhat different.
Mm-hmm.
Dame Daphne works with baby elephants, and Carol Buckley and Scott Blaze are working with elephants who are older than 20 years old, typically, between 20 and 30 and 40 years old, and they're mature elephants that have sustained many years in captivity. And so they've had a very different kind of a life. They have not had the inoculation, if you want to call it that, the inoculation of elephant society the way Dame Daphne recreates. So Carol at the sanctuary there, Carol and Scott, are essentially dealing with trauma recovery of adult individuals.
Is what we're learning about elephants and trauma, is it instructional for us as humans in treating humans with trauma?
Yes, I think it is, in many ways. One, I think it really shows how important some of the basics are that we seem to overlook, and that is having care and attention and social cohesion. The element that gives resilience to the baby elephants is the fact that they are surrounded by consistent, loving, caring family and community. And that is absolutely critical for trauma recovery. Now, that is something that traumatologists, that is human psychiatrists and psychologists, write about that is necessary for humans. But the difference between, say, the elephant community and our own is the elephant community has that very pro-social, is committed to this community living. And in our modern society, we are very fragmented. A lot of times when people go through trauma, they are returning, they don't return to an intact family and to an intact community. It's very fragmented. It's very divisive at times. And so the lesson that we're learning is in order for us to have positive and healthful mental well-being, we need to be able to really recreate a society and a community and a family, perhaps very much like the elephant, so that the key then for our own trauma is to really reconnect in our culture in a way that creates a kind of nurturing and healing medium.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, G.A. Bradshaw, Gay Bradshaw. She's the author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now from a listener in Urbana, now on line one. Hi.
Hi, I was in Zambia at a park and went on an elephant ride, and these elephants, they said, were from Zimbabwe, where they had been rescued because they were slaughtering them for food because of the political strife and the breakdown of the national parks there. And so there were these elephants. There were male and female elephants. There was even a two-year-old, and basically they were putting them to work once a day, I don't think every day. And what do you think of this kind of a situation for those elephants? Is that a good thing that they rescued them, but then, you know, put them to work? Or, you know, what would be better?
Hi. Thank you for your inquiry. Well, I think the fact that they were rescued, it is true that that elephants have been slaughtered in Zimbabwe. And I think that any kind of effort to rescue is very important. And again, to answer this, I suggest that we put on these glasses of saying, let's say these elephants were humans. Yes, it's important sometimes that someone has to be removed from their homeland in order so that they actually are able to survive. But the reality is that these individuals were taken essentially into indenture. They became servants or slaves or however you want to call it. And the training is something that is very psychologically harmful. So from the perspective of psychology and psychiatry, we would say that these elephants are, you know, being abused. They are being used. They were rescued. That is to say they have physical survival, but mentally, socially, and emotionally, they're under severe duress.
So they're really distressed and very unhappy then, even though they seemed okay. You're saying they're really traumatized.
Well, I mean, I have to make that assumption based on, you know, I have never met them individually, but it's just like a person. In other words, if we took, it was a little bit sort of a similar, for example, if someone is, we rescue a father and a mother and a child, and they are under threat of being killed by someone, and we take them in, and yes, you know, they're given food and water and shelter and they're protected, but at the same time, we're asking them to give up their freedom. And
so you wouldn't support a park like this, like you wouldn't, you know, go for that ride or something?
No, that's essentially a servitude for these individuals.
I see. Okay. All right. Thank you for all your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I just happened to stumble on the program, and I just want to say it's amazingly wonderful. But my question is, I heard Ms. Bradshaw talking about the need for a ban on ivory. And so my question is she talking about in the U.S. or worldwide? Because I thought that we had a ban on ivory in the U.S. So is my understanding incorrect, or was there a ban and it expired? Thank you very much.
Yes. Thanks for the call.
No, this is after me reading a lot of economic analyses from experts who have done this from different organizations. It would be a global ban. There would be a global ban that would prevent any kind of ivory trade. There has been, it has been lifted. It was very effective in the 1980s by having a ban, and that really pulled elephants back from the brink of extinction. And so that is what people who are, you know, seasoned in this area have said, that we need to reinstate that, and it would have an effect almost immediately. That's their opinion in that way. Now, there's other movements afoot in terms of trying to, to do other things in conservation, which would expand elephant habitat. I talked about that earlier, which was very important as well. So the ivory ban is absolutely critical. However, it's also very important to expand their habitat and to undertake measures that will stop the quote-unquote human-elephant conflict. And again, a large part of that has to do with elephants not having the habitat. They're starving. They don't have food and water. And so we have to take immediate steps in that direction as well, because what's happening is people are killing elephants just at a sort of a low level, not necessarily for their ivory, but to stop them from going into their croplands or coming into the villages and doing damage both to humans as well as to property. So that's a very important component, and that is a critical one in Asia, in Asian countries, where the habitat of the elephant has just been reduced dramatically with expansion and conversion of elephant habitat into different kinds of crops.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're wrapping things up here now with our guest this afternoon, G.A. Bradshaw. At the end of the book, there is an appendix about what we can do as here and now. 10 things you can do to help elephants. And since we've talked now here at the end, and we've had a couple of calls about what we can do with the choices that we make in our lives, maybe you would talk with us a little bit more about buying choices.
About buying choices?
Yeah, as consumers, our choices in the marketplace.
Well, like I said, one of the things is don't buy ivory or
right.
Sell ivory is obviously one of the critical kinds of things. And the other is in terms of not consuming materials that would destroy the elephant habitat, and that's a very important component to making sure that elephants have a place to live and that they don't lose more of their land. This would be, you know, things like don't buy, you know, any other products that are associated with, you know, elephant parts or in general for animals. It's also advised not to buy products that contain palm oil. There's a huge demand for palm oil, and so that's been used to convert land that's elephant habitat into croplands. And many, we can find it in many different elements like soap and cosmetics and things like that. So that's a very important thing. Unfortunately, coffee and chocolate as well. Again, there's a lot of areas that are cleared to produce chocolate and or cocoa and coffee. So to be very careful when you're looking at labels. And then again, the other one is having to do with timber products. This is particularly the case in Asia. So again, to be very careful. And I think in general, I mean, what now we're experiencing with the elephant, we experience all over, that our consumerism has taken a terrible toll on the animal kingdom, and we need to learn how to cut back and live much more simply. It's much more wonderful to have the animals around than it is to take away their habitat. So, you know, I guess the general encouragement is to, you know, curb our consumerism. Mm.
Gay Bradshaw, thank you very much for talking with us this
thank
afternoon.
You.
Gay Bradshaw is the author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. The book is published by the Yale University Press. More about our guest and her work at the website, www.kerulos.org. That's K-E-R-U-L-O-S. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here with all those numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. The numbers in Chicago finished up the day like this. Nearby futures in the wheat pit sharply higher. Corn futures up 18 to 19 cents. And soybeans up 30 to 35 today. So how'd they settle out in the December contract like this? $4.96.5 was the high price for the D sweet, the low at $4.69.25, with the settlement price up near the top at $4.94.25, 26 and a quarter higher for the afternoon. March futures, $5.15.5, the high, the low at $4.90.75, settlement price at $5.13.25, up 25 and three quarters. And the May futures in the wheat pit, $5.28.5, the high, the low at $5.06.25. And a settlement price at $5.26.25, up 24.5 cents. July futures, $5.42, the high, the low at $16.25. Settlement price at $5.40, up 23.75. In September contract, $5.57, the high, low at $41.5, settled at $5.53.75, up 22.5 cents. December corn futures, 19 cents higher, $3.83.5, the high, the low at $64.75. Settlement price at $3.81.25, up 19. March contract, $3.95, the high, the low at $76.5, settled at $3.93, up 18.5, and the May contract, $4.03, the high, the low at $3.83, settlement price at $4.01, up 18, July corn, $4.09.25, the high, low at $3.91.25, settlement price at $4.07.75, up 17.25, and September futures, $4.14, the high, the low at $4.01, settled $4.13.75, September corn up 15.75, December of 2010, a $4.20 top, bottom at $4.06, settlement price at $4.19.5, up 14.25. December oats today, $2.55.25, the high, low at $2.41, settlement price at $2.54.75, up 14.75. The March $2.67.75, up 14.25. Soy complex now, November beans, $10.75 the high, the low at $9.65. Did it make it to $10 at the end of the day? Nope, didn't finish there. $9.99, up 35 still on the afternoon. January futures, $10.02 the high, the low at $9.68. Settlement price at $10 even, up 33 cents in the March contract. $10.01, the high, the low at $9.70. Settlement price at $10.05, up 32.5 cents. May beans, $9.96, the high, the low at $9.62. Settled at $9.94, up 29.5. And July, $9.94.75, the high, the low at $9.60.25. Settlement price at $9.93, up 29.25 cents. August contract in the bean pit for the day, $9.91, up 31. And next year's November's a $9.82 top, bottom at $9.48. Settlement price at $9.79, up 30 cents on the day. October bean meal, $3.22.90, the high, the low at $3.12.20. Settlement price at $322.80, up $12.50. December bean meal, $3.07.80, the high, the low at $2.98.20. Settlement price at $3.07.30, up $10. October soybean oil, $36.16, the high, the low at $35.24. Settled $36.30, up $1.39, and December $36.79, the high, low at $35.20. Settlement price at $36.55. December soybean oil up $1.20. 8:35. In just about 9 minutes, I'll return with the closing mark report this afternoon. We will talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's out of Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. That'll happen on this Columbus Day edition of the Closing Mark Report in just 9 minutes. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from the Westchester Group in Champaign, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in the acquisition, management, and disposition of agricultural investments for institutional, corporate, and individual clients. Information at 800-607-6888 or at westchester-group.com.
Now let's take a look at the livestock contracts. October live cattle, the high today, 82.60, the low, 82.05, the settlement, 82.20, down 42.5. December, 85.52.5, the high, 84.90, the low, 85.30, the settlement, that up 35. February, 86.45, the high, 85.90, the low, 86.20, the settlement, that up 27.5. April, 88.50, the high, 88.10, the low, 88.40, the settlement, up 22.5. October feeder cattle, 94.25, the high, 93.90, the low, 94.02.5, the settlement, that down 15. November, 94.45, the high, 94 even, the low, 94.17.5, the settlement, down 30. January, 95.07.5, the high, 94.60, the low, 95.02.5, the settlement, that unchanged. March, 96.45 the high, 96 even the low, 96.32.5 the settlement, that contract down a nickel. October lean hogs, 50.90 the high, 50.05 the low, 50.12.5 the settlement, down 72.5. December, 54.15 the high, 52.80 the low, 53.82.5 the settlement, that up 105. February, 60.15 the high, 59.35 the low, 59.52.5 the settlement, that up 52.5. April, 65 even the high, 64 even the low, the settlement, 64.95, that up 80. February pork bellies, 85.20 the high, the low, 84.40, the settlement, 84.90, that finishing up 65 cents. The Dow is currently down 13 points at 98.52. The NASDAQ is off 7 at 21.32. The S&P 500 up a point at 1,073. Nearby crude up 1.33 a barrel to 73.10. 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft, our technical director, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Coming up later today on The World from PRI, nearly half the people in one Lebanese village are kicking themselves. They placed their savings with a financier, a religious man, who inspired trust and promised big returns. A Middle East Bernie Madoff takes investors for millions. That story from Lebanon and the day's news coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock on